Like a shot, I was back into the hallway, racing toward the kitchen window. Old Man Hunter screamed something after me that I couldn't make out, but nothing could have stopped me from slipping back through those bars like so much water. Marcus helped me through and then cupped his hands to give me a boost back up onto the brick wall. I was a ways beyond professional pride at that point. I used the rope to get back down into the alleyway, then grabbed the end that was still on that side of the wall. Looking around quickly, I found a water pipe with a spigot standing nearby. I tied the rope off onto it, then whispered, "Go!" Marcus's boots scratched against the wall as he climbed up top, and then he pretty much just let himself fall to ground on the other side. The studs on the boots hitting the concrete alleyway hard and, to judge by the look on his face, painfully. "Pull it over," he said, from which I took it that he'd untied the other end of the rope. I gave it a yank, and it came over with a whipping sound. Coiling it up around my arm quickly as we ran back to the open rear window of the stables, I handed the thing to Marcus, who stuffed it away in his satchel. Then we got through the window, closed it, and jumped back into the calash and under the tarpaulin, both of us breathing as hard as little Mike. "What do we do?" I asked, the quick heaving of my chest making it hard to whisper. "Shh," Marcus answered. For a long few seconds we just lay there, listening. Some dogs were barking in the yards behind the stables, and in the far distance we could hear Micah Hunter yelling away, though his exact words were still impossible to make out. "I think we'll be all right," Marcus finally said. "The people around here must be used to that kind of thing from him. We can't panic." He pulled out a watch and checked it. "Lucius should be here within half an hour. Just catch your breath and try not to move." I followed the order. Taking in deep gulps of air as I stroked the confused Mike through the leather of the satchel. "Shit," I finally said, when I could do it quietly. "I think the old maniac really might have shot me." "It was the fireworks," Marcus said, "and the morphine. My bet is she gives him a hell of a dose before she leaves at night. If you get woken up during the first couple of hours after a strong injection like that, you're generally pretty delusional. He seemed to think he was back in the war, and you were some Confederate kid he'd shot somewhere along the line." Marcus paused to take in air. "What about the baby?" "Long story," I said. "She's down there all right. I don't think we're wrong about that, but getting to her is going to be tough, maybe impossible. The rack of preserves is some kind of mechanical doorway, and it won't give. I found some other stuff, though." I clammed right up when I heard a soft tapping on the side of the calash. "Stevie? Marcus?" It was Detective Sergeant Lucius. "Are you in there?" "Yes," Marcus answered, "and we're all right." "I heard shouting," Lucius said, "from inside. What happened?" "Later," Marcus whispered. "Get us out of here." "What about the girl? Did you find her?" "Lucius, get us out of here, now." In a few seconds, the calash started to roll out toward the front of the stables. Lucius paused to pay the attendant, and then it was out onto the street, turning left. He'd rightly decided to head uptown along the river, as far from the duster's joint as possible. Within half a block he had Frederick up to a nice clip, and when we felt the carriage turn right, Marcus and I figured it was safe to come out from under the tarpaulin. The sky above the Hudson was still blazing with fireworks, and there were groups of people all along the waterfront watching them. But we didn't pause for any sightseeing, just kept cantering forward toward number 808 Broadway. Lucius was full of questions, but Marcus told him to hold them all till we got there. I undid my satchel to see if Mike was okay, and found him peering up at me, still very agitated but otherwise fine. With that, I took a deep breath and leaned back on the seat of the calash. Bringing the stolen papers out from inside my shirt, I handed them to Marcus, then lit up a cigarette and offered him one. We were both bitterly disappointed about how things had worked out. And because of this, the warm welcome we received from the others, whose disappointment could not have been much less than ours when we got back to number 808, was all the more appreciated. I think that both Marcus and I, in mulling over what had happened, had forgotten just how much more wrong things could have gone. But the relief what was clear in the faces of all our friends served as a reminder. Miss Howard offered me a big hug that lifted me clear off the ground, while the doctor put an arm around my shoulders and near squeezed them through to each other, smiling all the while. The fact that we hadn't succeeded was obviously far less important than the fact that we'd survived, and seeing that thought reflected in all their faces in turn made it much easier to talk about the break-in. The doctor had ordered supper from Mr. Delmonico and had it brought down to our headquarters, a fact what put the joy of life back into Marcus. As for me, I was deeply grateful that the doctor had not only ordered me a plain grilled steak and fried potatoes, but had had Mr. Ranhofer send along a few fillets of raw beef for Mike, too. Mr. Moore had set all the food out on the billiard table, buffet style. There were olives and celery, anchovies on toast, pheasant and guinea fowl, complete with ornamental feathers, foie gras aspic, lamb chops, lobster and shrimp salad, rice pudding, small meringues with fruit, Neapolitan iced cream, and, of course, bottles of champagne, wine, and beer, along with root beer for me. As the adults all got platefuls of their luxurious fare, I retreated into my windowsill with my steak, the beef fillets, and Mike, who proved to be almost as hungry as yours truly. One by one the others made their way over to the big chairs and desks with their suppers and drinks, and as they did, we all started to go over the strange events that Marcus and I had just been through, a process what began with the two of us laying out the basic facts and ended with Marcus handing the papers I'd lifted over to the doctor. As he did, I saw for the first time a bit of a cloud float into Dr. Kreitzler's features. "What's wrong, doctor?" Marcus said, opening up some windows to let the warm evening breeze come into the place, along with the sounds of celebration from the street. "From what I could see, those documents may be the evidence we need to demonstrate a pattern in this woman's behavior."
"That may be, Marcus," the doctor said, going over the papers. "I cannot yet tell, but what they most certainly will do, or rather, what their absence will do, is let Nurse Hunter know who broke into her house and why."
"Well, come on, Kreitzler," Mr. Moore said, carefully setting an overloaded plate onto an arm of one of the easy chairs. "If our visit on Sunday wasn't an open declaration of hostilities, I don't know what would be."
"It is not hostility toward us that concerns me more," the doctor answered, still reading the hospital reports. "It is the possibility that our attempts to rescue the child may eventually be interpreted in Nurse Hunter's mind as the child's fault. That is her peculiar ability to turn responsibility for all that goes wrong in her own life as well as the lives of the children she touches back onto the children themselves."
The doctor turned to a new sheet of paper as the rest of us absorbed that disturbing notion. Then his eyes suddenly went very big.
"My God!"
He quickly set his plate aside so that he could tear into the stack of documents faster.
"My God!" he repeated.
"What have you found, doctor?" Miss Howard asked for all of us. But the doctor only looked to Marcus.
"How many of these letters did you read?"
Marcus shrugged, gnawing on a lamb chop. "Just enough to get the general idea. A child named Jonathan was in her care and went through several cyanotic episodes. The last one was fatal." The doctor pounded a finger on the stack of papers.
"Yes, but the relationship was not that of nurse to patient. This last admitting form reveals the child's family name, Hatch. He was Jonathan Hatch, her own son."
Even my jaw dropped at that one, and I thought right away about the series of photographs of babies and children that I'd seen in the secretary at No. 39 Bethune Street.
"She was not a nurse at St. Luke's," the doctor went on. "She brought the child in as a patient, three times."
Marcus just sat there, the lamb chop bone dangling from his hand.
"But I just assumed..."
The doctor waved him off, the motion of his hand saying, of course, as clearly as his voice could have. He kept on reading and digging, then his voice went shocked again.
"Good Lord! She lists her place of employment as 1 West 57th Street."
Mr. Moore's wine glass hit the floor with a crash.
"Christ!" he said in shock. "That's Cornel Vanderbilt's house."
Cyrus was still struggling with the first bit of new information.
"But I thought we'd decided that the woman was incapable of having children."
The doctor just kept waving his hand.
"True, Cyrus, and there's nothing to say that she... Wait, here."
He'd grabbed the newspapers that were at the bottom of the pile and handed them to Cyrus.
"See what sense you can make of these."
His mouth full of pheasant, Cyrus picked up his plate with one hand and took the papers with the other, moving to one of the desks where he could both read and eat. The doctor kept his eyes on the hospital reports.
Each of the events conforms precisely to the pattern described by the nurses at the lying-in hospital. Every time that the woman, described here as Mrs. Elspeth Hatch, arrived at the hospital, the child, Jonathan, 18 months old, was already choking and cyanotic. Each incident occurred in the middle of the night. The mother claimed to have been awoken by the sound of his gasping and rushed to find him unable to breathe. The first two letters are quite dramatic. Had you, Mrs. Hatch, displayed any less alacrity in bringing the child into professional hands, writes the attending physician in the initial communication, he should most certainly have expired. Your anguish as you waited to learn of his fate was, according to our staff, most touching to behold. Who in God's name wrote that? As Dr. Chrysler read on, I remembered that he'd often worked with colleagues who were attending physicians at St. Luke's. Dr. J. Langham. I don't know him. He should go into dime novels, Mr. Moore said, wiping up the wine and broken glass that covered the floor by his chair with a napkin. Does it say anything more about Vanderbilt? No, the doctor answered, but she was apparently living in a flat near 57th Street. That's why she took the child to St. Luke's. The hospital was still located on 54th Street at the time. Here are some more statistics. Under age, she writes 37. Occupation, day maid. Place of birth, Stillwater, New York. The doctor looked up. Anyone? Upstate? Lucius tried. There isn't a great deal of downstate from here, Lucius, Miss Howard said with a smile. I know the town, doctor. It's on the upper Hudson near Saratoga. She cleared her throat proudly and took a small bite of food. Exactly, if anyone cares to remember, the area in which I placed her by her accent. Congratulations, Sarah, the doctor said. Let's hope you are as successful with the next set of mysteries. Cyrus, any luck with those newspapers? Cyrus didn't answer. He'd stopped eating altogether, though he was only halfway done with his food. And he was staring at the old, yellowing newsprint as if he were reading about his own death. Cyrus? The doctor repeated. When he turned and saw the look on the man's face, he immediately got out of his chair and rushed over to him. What is it? What have you found? Looking up slowly, Cyrus seemed to stare right through the doctor. She's done it before. Mr. Moore asked, What do you mean, done what? But the rest of us were silent, having gotten the point of what Cyrus was saying, though not wanting to. Cyrus touched the papers and turned to Mr. Moore. There's four clippings here. The first three are from the Journal in the World. They all contain stories about a kidnapping in May 1895. A couple named Johansson, they owned a grocery store on East 55th Street and had a son, Peter, 16 months old. The mother was attacked on a side street when she was bringing the baby home alone. The boy was taken, and no ransom note was ever received. As Cyrus said all of this, the doctor grabbed the newspapers hungrily and began to scan them. "And the last paper?" he asked. "A copy of the Times," Cyrus answered. 2 months later, it lists a death notice for Jonathan Hatch. Age 18 months. Survived by his loving mother. Libby, the doctor finished. Then he waved an arm at Lucius. Detective Sergeant, on those forms there should be a physical description of the child. Lucius ran over and picked up the hospital forms. Description, description, he mumbled, going through the things. Here we are, description. What do you have for hair and eye coloring? The doctor asked. Let me see. Length, weight, yes, eyes, blue, hair, blonde. Typical Scandinavian coloring, the doctor murmured. Not that it's conclusive at such an age, but... He slapped his hand down. Why does she keep these? As trophies? Or as mementos? Holding a little more raw beef in front of Mike's mouth and watching him grab it away and then rip into it, I said quietly, She's got his picture. The doctor looked my way. Indeed, Stevie. I turned to him and nodded. It was in the secretary. Little blonde boy, blue eyes. Picture looked pretty recent. I mean, compared to... I stopped, suddenly realizing what you might call the implications of what I was about to say. Yes, Stevie, the doctor asked quietly.
compared to the others? I answered, looking out the window to the dark churchyard below and suddenly feeling cold. She's got more. A couple of individual kids, babies, like the Linares girl and this one. Then there's a picture of three other kids all together. They were older.
Again, there was silence for a second. Then Mr. Moore mumbled,
"You don't think... not all of them."
"I don't think anything," the doctor answered, walking to the chalkboard.
"But that..." Mr. Moore went for another drink. "I mean, the whole idea, it's... unnatural."
Marcus had said the word, and I turned to find him looking at me. He was remembering, I was sure, that moment when we'd first found ourselves in the dead, dismal yard at number 39 Bethune Street.
"I really do urge you to dispense with that word," the doctor replied quietly. "All of you. It isn't worth the breath its utterance requires, and it distracts us from the more important result of this encounter. We have opened one door only to find ourselves faced with many more."
Picking up a piece of chalk, the doctor set to work on the board.
"We have a host of new leads, and, quite probably, new crimes to pursue. The worst of this business, I fear, lies ahead of us."
Everybody's appetite seemed to slack off quite a bit with that realization. Everybody's but Mike's. Slowly becoming aware of his noisy chewing, I looked down to see him sitting in my lap, gnawing away, happy as he probably knew how to be. I put my finger behind his ear and scratched at his soft fur. "Next time you get to feeling sorry you're a ferret and not a person, Mike," I muttered, "I want you to remember all this." The doctor turned around to find a collection of blank, depressed faces, and sensing that motivation was dwindling away, he marched back over to his plate of food and his wine and picked them up.
"Come, come," he said, maybe more cheerfully than he felt. "This meal is entirely too good to waste, and none of you will be able to work on an empty stomach."
Mr. Moore looked up in bleary confusion.
"Work? Certainly, Moore,"
the doctor answered, eating a bit of foie gras on a toast point and taking a sip of wine.
"We have now catalogued the information we gained from this little escapade. It remains to be interpreted. When our adversary returns home, she will doubtless realize what we have been about and adjust her movements and actions to it. Time, therefore, presses now more than ever."
"But Kreitzler," Mr. Moore said, unconvinced, "what's there to interpret? We can't get the Linares kid out, not without tearing the house apart. We still can't go to the cops, and once this woman, whatever the hell name she's using, tells Goo-Goo Knox what's happened, we'll all have to spend our nights ducking attacks from the damned Hudson Dusters. Now, what the hell do you think we're going to do that's going to change any of that?"
Lucius was holding his face in his hands, and it was sinking between them.
"The woman has covered herself awfully well, Doctor, just as Sarah said the other day."
He lifted his head and pulled out a handkerchief, starting to wipe sweat from his brow, but soon giving up.
"I realize this point's been made before, but the Beecham case was so much more direct. He was challenging us, and there were things that we could grab onto, points that we could proceed to and from with some kind of logic. But this, every time you think you're getting somewhere, you find out something new that changes the entire picture."
"I know, Detective Sergeant, I know," the doctor answered quickly. "But remember one essential difference between this case and our last. Some hidden part of Beecham desperately wanted to be stopped."
"The sane part of him," Mr. Moore said. "So are you saying this Libby Hatch is insane? Because if she is, not insane, John." The doctor went to the board and wrote the word sane under the woman's names, then underlined it. "But characterized by so severe a lack of self-knowledge, of self-awareness, that her behavior becomes incoherent enough to seem insane sometimes. On the other hand, she can often be quite coherent. As you have all pointed out, this time she has managed to shield her actions very well."
Marcus looked up.
"This time?" he echoed.
Yes,
the doctor answered as he sipped his wine.
"This time."
He drew a large box under the section of the board labeled "The Woman on the Train," and proceeded to label the box "Past Crimes." Then he wrote the numbers 1 through 6 underneath the label. Next to the number 1, he scratched Peter Johansson, 1895,
kidnapped, May, became Jonathan Hatch, died St. Luke's Hospital, July, suffocated.
And indeed, the doctor went on, stepping back, why should she not have been ready this time? She has certainly had enough practice. If we are interpreting the elements presented to us correctly, I think we can assume that all of the children that Stevie saw in the photographs, at least six by my count, and perhaps more, were believed by the Hatch woman to be her own, either because they in fact were, or by way of still more kidnappings. And we can be just as certain that they were her victims.
She keeps pictures of children she's murdered in her house, Mr. Moore said.
Don't sound so shocked, Moore. After all, we have already posited that she does not hold herself responsible for their deaths. Her mind will not allow it. In her view, they die despite her, not because of her. They are wanton, imperfect, defective children who defy her tireless maternal efforts to nurture them.
We've granted all that, Doctor, Miss Howard said, herself sounding a little downcast. And she was always the last person to show flagging spirits. But how can it help us here? I mean, practically speaking. How can we use it to rescue a child whose father has no interest in rescuing her, who in fact dispatches his macabre family servant to warn us against rescuing her? The doctor turned to her quickly.
And so what should we do, Sarah? Drop the case? When we know that the girl will die, and soon? And when we have no idea what the political repercussions of that death may be?
No. Miss Howard spoke quickly, battling herself as much as the doctor. But I just can't see any way into the thing any more. Moving over to crouch by her, the doctor took Miss Howard's head in his hands.
That's because you're thinking like yourself, Sarah. Directly, in a straight, linear fashion. Think like her. Be indirect, oblique, even devious.
He picked up her plate and handed it to her.
But above all, eat.
Doctor, Marcus, who had managed to finish his dinner, stood up, pointing at the board with his bottle of beer.
I think I understand. We, Stevie and I, when we were at their house, we saw things, and we started to understand things. About her, I mean. She may have planned this crime well, but that doesn't change the fact that she's not the most capable of women in many other ways.
I'll say, I threw in, you should have seen their kitchen. I wouldn't eat in it for love or money, and the yard, it's like a cemetery.
Go on, the doctor said, encouraged.
Well, Marcus took a deep pull off his bottle. It seems inconceivable that a woman like that could pull off six separate crimes as effectively as this one. And we also have to remember that part of what seems like her skill here was just luck. If she had no idea who Anna Linares was, then she couldn't have known that the child's father would refuse to look for her or go to the police. So, in fact, she has made mistakes. We just can't do anything about them. But that doesn't stop us from pursuing her elsewhere, in the past, I mean.
Oh, this is perfect, Mr. Moore moaned. The case has fallen to pieces, and now Marcus thinks he's H.G. Wells. Well, when you build your little time machine, Marcus, we'll all pile in and...
No. Wait, John. Miss Howard's green eyes had gotten their usual glitter back, and she sat up. He's right. She must have slipped up somewhere in the past. It's just that no one was looking for it at the time. If we hold off on the Linares case for now and dig around in some of these other deaths, then we can come at her from a blind side.
After all, Moore, the doctor agreed, look at the new leads we have obtained. We now know where the woman comes from. That is crucial and must be explored, for all such killers manifest some sort of aberrant behavior early in life. And we are nearly certain of the crime she committed before the Linares kidnapping. It was dismissed as a natural occurrence at the time, but if we interview the doctors involved and review the matter in light of what we now know, we have a very good chance of changing that interpretation.
Mr. Moore had been listening to all this carefully, and I could see he wanted to keep arguing. But something seemed to come into his head.
Sarah, did you say that her hometown's near Saratoga?
Miss Howard's face screwed up at the disconnected nature of the question.
Stillwater? Yes, it's about 15 miles southeast of the Springs, more or less.
right on the river. Why, John?
Mr. Moore thought about it for a second, then held up a finger. I've got a friend. He used to work in the Manhattan District Attorney's office, but he grew up near Saratoga. A few years back he had to leave New York, and he's now working in the DA's office up there. Boston Spa's still the county seat, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, Miss Howard answered with a nod.
Well, Mr. Moore went on, if this Hatch woman did cross any legal lines up there, Kreitzler, then Rupert Picton is the man for us to talk to. A born prosecutor, loves to dig up dirt. There, you see, John, the doctor lifted his glass. How difficult was that? And let's not forget, we have established a link between the woman and the Vanderbilts at the time of the last murder. It must be investigated.
At the mention of the great family's name, Mr. Moore's face turned evilly gleeful, like a boy with a box of matches.
Yes, and I want in on that one, he said. Cornel Vanderbilt, that pious, pompous old... I want to be there when we tell him his dame-maid spent her off-hours kidnapping kids and suffocating them.
Let's not flat-out jump to conclusions, gentlemen, Lucius said. We have just one possible homicide at this point, along with two definite kidnappings.
Oh, I know that, and you know that, Lucius, Mr. Moore said. But Vanderbilt doesn't. I want to tweak his nose that...
You've made your point, John, the doctor interrupted. And you shall be there when Vanderbilt is interviewed. One final question remains.
Starting his normal pacing of the floor, a signal somehow that we'd beaten back the moment of doubt and were going to proceed with the job, the doctor took to shaking his chalk in his free hand.
We know that Libby Hatch, as I think we should now refer to her, almost certainly will reach a fatal crisis with Anna Linares. I also believe, after hearing Stevie and Marcus's story about the condition of her husband, that she is slowly killing him with morphine, in such a way that his death will be viewed as a result of his own degeneracy, thus gaining her the kind of sympathy and admiration she seems, from all accounts, to crave. There are collateral benefits to his demise as well, inheritance of both his pension and what I suspect is his house, not to mention the removal of any obstruction to her activities with Knox. The pressing question is, how can we forestall these events? If we continue to conceal ourselves from her, she will believe we are beaten. If, on the other hand, we make her aware that we are investigating her past,
then she won't feel safe to murder again, Miss Howard finished. At least not until we have left her alone.
Are you talking about a direct statement to her, Doctor? Lucia said. I've got to remind you of what John said about the Dusters. If she knows we're after her, she'll tell Knox to turn them loose on us.
Which is why you shall make the declaration, Detective Sergeant, you and Marcus. And not in our name, in that of your department. We may in fact be prevented from making this an official inquiry, but there's no reason why she should know that, is there?
You need not present any warrants or indictments, only the simple statement that the department is aware of her past actions and will be watching her future movements. If you create the impression that you are speaking in an official capacity, she will pass that impression on to Knox. The Hudson Dusters, while violent, are neither ambitious nor suicidal. One very much doubts that they will jeopardize either their freedom, their access to cocaine, or their status as romantic bohemian idols for anyone's sake, including that of Knox's paramour du jour.
Marcus looked to his brother. He's got a point.
Far more than a point, the doctor answered, collecting the newspapers and hospital documents and holding them up. We now have her past. Or pieces of it, at any rate. That is what we have been missing. Some hint of what lies behind the current behavior, some way in, as Sarah puts it. Until now we have been crippled primarily by the lack of any guidance from my own profession, which, like the rest of our society, suffers from a myopia which prevents us from seeing that a woman, a mother, can be capable of such crimes. And so we have moved haltingly, unsteadily, trying to know things about this particular woman that each of us, in some recess of our own minds, wishes was unknowable and untrue. Oh, we may have had her physical image and evidence of her most recent destructive behavior, but how much could we truly read into that? Now, however,
We have specific details of her past. Keys. And we must not hesitate before using them.
Except, perhaps, Doctor, Miss Howard suddenly rose and looked my way, to take a moment to acknowledge the person whose bravery got us here. She held her wine glass up to me. I shifted uneasily as the others then turned. Discouragement was gone from their faces and had been replaced by confidence, readiness, and smiles. One by one they each held up their glasses and bottles, and I don't mind saying it made me nervous as hell. But I was smiling a little too.
"To Stevie," Miss Howard went on, "who's done what none of us could have done," she continued, "because he's lived what none of us have lived."
The rest of them all said to Stevie together, took big sips of their drinks, and then came at me in a wave. I just looked at Mike, and then out the window, as uncomfortable and as pleased as I can ever remember being.
"Okay, okay," I said, shielding myself with my hands from their displays of affection and appreciation. "We got work to do, remember?"
Chapter 25. On Sunday, Mike the ferret went home with Hickey, and I no longer had a companion to help me forget how badly I'd left things with Cat. But Monday morning saw our investigation pick up pace, and I was soon too busy carting the doctor and the others around town to think much about where she might be or what she might be doing. I knew that she'd written to her aunt and was waiting for a reply before heading to California, and I could only hope that she'd see her way clear to contacting me before then. But hoping was a step up from worrying, and as Cat had her money and her ticket now, I figured it was safe to put my fears for her aside, regardless of whether or not I heard from her. The doctor, Mr. Moore, and I started out Monday morning on the long trip up to St. Luke's Hospital, which had moved the year before from its old home on 54th Street to five new buildings between Amsterdam Avenue and Morningside Drive at 114th Street. I saw the doctor and Mr. Moore as far as the entrance to one of the pavilions, by coincidence, the Vanderbilt Pavilion, where nurses in long sky-blue dresses and white aprons were trying to keep little white caps perched on their heads as they shuffled quickly up and down a spiral steel staircase which surrounded a small elevator. The doctor and Mr. Moore got into the elevator and headed to an upper floor while I went back to the calash and drove down to Morningside Heights to spend the next few hours smoking a batch of cigarettes and looking down the steep rocks into the wide stretch of Harlem below. The visit didn't go as well as the doctor had hoped. Those physicians, surgeons, and nurses on the hospital staff, what had attended to Mrs. Libby Hatch and her son 2 years earlier, were horrified by the suggestion that she might have done the boy in, and the doctor had been forced to appeal to higher authorities in order to get access to official records. And those records hadn't revealed anything new about Mrs. Hatch's visits to the hospital. Like the documents I'd stolen from her house, they all said that she'd acted with speed and courage and kept herself composed throughout the ordeal in a way what had only inspired the admiration and sympathy of the staff of St. Luke's. This last bit interested the doctor particularly, he told me and Mr. Moore during the ride downtown. It seemed that in Germany there were a batch of alienists, psychologists, and nerve specialists, what they called neurologists, who, while studying the subject of female hysteria, had found that their patients could sometimes become as addicted to the attention of medical professionals as any morphine jabber or Bernie blower was to drugs. If Libby Hatch shared this need, the doctor said, she might have been using the illnesses of the children what she took care of, or failed to take care of, to satisfy it. It was two birds with one stone, you might say. She would have been covering up her maternal inabilities and getting attention and praise from doctors and nurses in the process. We'd know for sure if she did have such a craving when we got more information about her past, as it was a characteristic that would have formed early in life and showed up over and over. The day might even come when we could use the need against her somehow, being as, like any fiending behavior, it was at bottom a severe weakness and handicap, one what could betray and even destroy the person afflicted with it.
Mr. Moore, after considering all this, threw the idea that such a craving could have been the reason why Libby Hatch or Mrs. Hunter had treated Dr. Kreitzler in a very different way than she'd approached either himself or the detective sergeants. True, she'd come at each man in a fashion designed to appeal to his weakness or vanity, but maybe there was something more in her very respectful treatment of the doctor. Maybe she hadn't figured on such a person taking part in the investigation of the abduction, and maybe when she'd tried to be cordial to him as we were all leaving, she'd felt a real need for him to respond in kind, to believe that she was innocent. Certainly, that would help explain the furious way she'd reacted when he'd rejected her attempts to be cordial. And, Mr. Moore continued, if she did harbor some sneaking desire to be approved of by the doctor, the fact that he was going to stay on the case with the cops might be something the detective sergeants would want to include in their warning to her. A little worm to plant in her brain, so to speak, just to help keep her off balance. When we met up with Marcus and Lucius that night at 17th Street, they agreed with this line of reasoning wholeheartedly, and decided to make it a part of their presentation. That event would not take place, though, until after they, with the help of Miss Howard, had further investigated the deaths of the babies at the lying-in hospital, being as they wanted to be loaded with as much ammunition as possible when they faced our opponent. But this side investigation proved especially tricky, being as it was difficult, if not impossible, to even locate most of the mothers of said babies, much less get them to talk. The lying-in hospital, like I've said, catered to unwed and poor mothers, and a lot of them didn't give their right names when they checked in. This was true in particular of the more well-to-do women who were in the hospital to cover the results of adultery or who'd enjoyed the advantages of matrimony before actually bothering with its formalities. It took the detective sergeants and Miss Howard days to find even a single woman who'd acknowledge that one of the dead babies had been hers. And when they did find that lone mother and told her about their suspicions, the woman showed them out in a hurry, smelling legal trouble and wanting no part of it. So they were forced to press on with their search. The doctor and Mr. Moore, meanwhile, went about their next task, getting in to see the Honorable Mr. Cornelius Vanderbilt II, him what Mr. Moore had referred to as Cornel. The name distinguished him from his grandfather, the larcenous old coot who'd put the family on the map, and also from his own son, Cornelius III, who was called Neely. He was a generous man when it came to charities, was Mr. Cornelius II, but he was also about the most holier-than-thou customer in New York, and he certainly had no interest in meeting with someone as questionable as Dr. Kreitzler. If any of our team was going to be admitted to the enormous mansion, which was known to architectural types as a French Renaissance chateau that took up the whole end of the block of Fifth Avenue between 57th and 58th Streets, favors were going to have to be asked of third parties. Specifically, Mr. Moore would have to seek the help of his parents, something he genuinely despised doing. And though they did fix an audience up for Thursday afternoon, they also told Mr. Moore that whatever his business was, he'd better make sure he didn't bring up the subject of Mr. Vanderbilt's son, Neely, whose existence the old gent wasn't currently recognizing. Apparently young Neely had had the nerve to go and marry somebody he actually loved, but who his family considered socially below him. The battle over the marriage had become so hot that Cornelius II had actually had a stroke and pretty well written his oldest son out of his will. The young man himself had gone through with the marriage, then hightailed it to Europe with his bride. They'd only recently returned, though the city'd been buzzing with word of their doings the whole while. The yellow press, of course, had jumped into the thing and all on the side of love, the better to sell papers. Most of high society was likewise sympathetic to the young couple, since really old New York families, like Mr. Moore's and Miss Howard's, considered the recently rich Vanderbilts gatecrashers at their long-running party in the first place. The affair had continued to wear on Cornelius II, who was now migrating between his palace in New York and his even more ridiculously elaborate joint in Newport, Rhode Island, and by that summer he'd grown so bitter and self-righteous that it was actually killing him. $70 million and the New York Central Railroad system all his own to play with, and the man was going to let two young people's romantic escapades drive him into the ground. There was and is no figuring rich people sometimes. Anyway, Thursday afternoon arrived, and we drove uptown in the covered calash. The average daily temperature had been steadily going up as we dragged deeper into July, and by the 8th it was rising so fast that it was causing that depressing type of warm summer rain that always fails to cool or cleanse the city. Sloshing our way through particularly nasty-smelling horse waste, we rolled over Murray Hill and then entered the mansion district in the 50s, eventually passing the other Vanderbilt palaces, what had all been built within a few blocks of Cornelius II's. The main purpose of each of those mansions, it had always seemed to me, was nothing more than to outdo the rest, even if that meant piling on so many details and extras that the structures themselves crossed over into what you might call laughable or just plain unsightly. This was true of 1 West 57th Street most of all. The bright red color of the bricks against the whiteness of the limestone used for the window frames and detailing may have been supposed to recreate the look of the French Renaissance, but for my money, it came a lot closer to a circus tent. The addition that had been built onto the back of the house by Mr. Richard Morris Hunt, him what had designed the new wing of the Metropolitan Museum, was much easier on the eyes and could even be considered handsome, if looked at apart from the rest. But the effect of the front of the house, when you came at it from downtown, was to make you think that you were on your way to see some kind of high-class joker. Which, of course, you were. It was just too bad that Cornelius II himself didn't get the gag. About half a block south of 57th Street, the noise of our carriage, along with those around us, suddenly died. Huge sheets of some kind of padding, it looked like tree bark, had been laid down on the blocks around 1 West 57th so that the ailing Mr. Vanderbilt wouldn't be disturbed by the sounds of passing horses and rigs. It might seem unbelievable nowadays to think that whole city blocks would be repaved just to let one man rest easier. But Cornelius II was that important to the city, mostly because of his philanthropic work. Of course, it wasn't noise that was making him sick, as the doctor pointed out. You could have put the man into a room lined with concrete and lead, and so long as he had the thought of how little control he'd been able to exercise over his son to keep him company, his body would have continued to deteriorate. When we got to 1 West 57th, the doctor informed Mr. Moore that, especially as the interview had been so tough to obtain, he was not to enter it intending to tweak Mr. Vanderbilt's nose, as he'd said he wanted to. They'd just tell the sorry old invalid that they were trying to trace Mrs. Hatch's movements in order to contact her, being as they thought she could be of some assistance with the case the doctor was working on, nothing else. Mr. Moore reluctantly agreed, and then they walked on up the front steps to the big arched limestone doorway. Mr. Moore rang the doorbell, and a footman answered, saying that they were expected by Mr. Vanderbilt in the Moorish room at the back of the house. Knowing enough to realize that he was talking about a smoking room, what probably looked like a plate illustration for 1001 Nights, such rooms being all the rage among rich people in those days, I got down off the calash's driver's seat and, when the footman returned, asked him if he wouldn't mind keeping an eye on the carriage for a minute, as I had an errand I had to run for the doctor a few blocks uptown. The man very decently obliged, and I tore off to and around the corner of 5th Avenue. When I reached the back of the house, near the handsome porte cochere what Mr. Hunt had designed, I found that a fairly high cast-iron fence separated me from the backyard. I wouldn't have had any trouble getting over the thing, of course, but there were a few strollers around, even on that wet afternoon, and so a bit of caginess was called for. I tried an old trick. Looking to the high roof of the mansion across the street, which was only a bit less luxurious than Mr. Vanderbilt's, I pointed up and screamed, "He's going to jump!" This, of course, is the single statement guaranteed to get any and all New Yorkers to stop whatever they're doing and turn to search the direction indicated. The strollers out on 5th Avenue that afternoon were no exceptions, and in the few seconds it took them to realize that I'd been putting them on, I got over the Vanderbilt's fence and ran to hide behind one of the square columns of the porte cochere. Scanning the back of the house, I soon caught sight of an open bay window on the western end, out of which were drifting voices. I could easily hide on the far side of the bay, and did, allowing myself just one peek inside the room. If there's one word to describe the Vanderbilt family's taste, I'm not in possession of it. You could, I suppose, just say that they liked more. More stone with their stone, more frills with their frills, more artwork with their artwork, more food with their food. The Moorish room that I peered into that day was a very good example of all this. It wasn't enough that the wood of the walls, fully two stories high, was as expensive as possible, or that it was carved in more complicated patterns than the Arabian models, what it had been based on. No, the walls also had to be inlaid with other precious substances, including, if you can believe it, mother of pearl. Mother of pearl in your walls! If you can order that kind of nonsensical detail, and order it from no less a designer than Mr. Lewis Comfort Tiffany, then it's no wonder, I suppose, that you'd have a stroke when your own kid refused to do what you told him. Hanging from the high ceiling was a gigantic, bulbous Tiffany lamp with smaller lamps, also of Tiffany glass, suspended in a circle from the top of this central fixture. Below that conglomeration, set in front of a marble, Moorish fireplace and on top of several enormous, thick Persian carpets, were some straight-backed velvet chairs. In two of these sat the doctor and Mr. Moore, seeming very small in that room, and opposite them, covered in spite of the July heat by a rich fur blanket, was Mr. Vanderbilt, looking like what he was, a man on a slow but steady course to death. His long face and glaring eyes, which once could intimidate most men even from a good distance, were now full of a beaten sadness, and his voice was rough. "And what reason can you possibly have to come to me for such information?" he was asking. I ducked back down to hide and listen as Mr. Moore responded. "The woman was a servant of yours, Mr. Vanderbilt, for a time, at least. She listed you as her employer on some hospital forms we've seen." "What of it?" Mr. Vanderbilt answered, in a tone what you might politely call condescending. "Yes, she was employed here, but as to her private dealings, they were precisely that, and respected as such. Elspeth Hatch was a trusted servant. She had been since her arrival in the city." "And that was?" the doctor asked. I heard a hoarse sigh of exasperation come out of their host, causing Mr. Moore to add, "If the matter weren't so urgent, Mr. Vanderbilt—" "Urgent?" old man Vanderbilt cut in. "Urgent, yet you will not tell me what it is." "The confidentiality of patient and physician," the doctor replied. "I'm sure you understand." "And we really wouldn't impose on you," Mr. Moore said, "if we had any choice." "Well," Mr. Vanderbilt grunted, "at the very least you recognize that it is an imposition." "Had I any less regard for your family, Mr. Moore?" "Yes, sir," Mr. Moore answered, "quite." Another irritated sigh got out of Mr. Vanderbilt. "We engaged Elspeth Hatch in, I should say it was in, the summer of 1894, very soon after the tragedy. We had heard of her misfortune from friends upstate, and my wife thought that offering her a position, we needed a maid in any case, would offer her a chance to leave her home and put the past behind her. Mrs. Vanderbilt is a woman of uncommon compassion." He grunted again. "And breeding." There followed a few more silent moments, during which I figured that the doctor and Mr. Moore were glancing at each other, trying to come up with a way to find out what the tragedy Mr. Vanderbilt had mentioned was. Given his attitude, it didn't seem likely he'd share any information about his former servant's personal misfortune if he thought his visitors weren't already aware of it. "That was indeed uncommonly compassionate of your wife, sir," the doctor finally said. "And no doubt it helped Mrs. Hatch recover. A change of locale is often the only effective antidote to such an unfortunate experience." "Unfortunate experience?" Mr. Vanderbilt rumbled back. "Seeing your own children shot down before you by a madman? Are you a disciple of understatement, doctor, or have you simply become inured to tragedy through your work?" That statement caused my eyes to pop a bit, and I could only think of how hard the doctor and Mr. Moore must have been working to hide a like reaction. "I certainly didn't mean to sound callous, sir," the doctor finally said.
Perhaps my work sometimes does prevent me from treating murder.
He said the word carefully, as if he half expected a contradiction, but none came.
With the proper consideration, he finished.
Mr. Vanderbilt huffed, rather than grunted this time.
I suppose that's to be expected. At any rate, she arrived here just 2 or 3 months later, and she worked with uncommon diligence, considering that the fate of her eldest daughter remained so uncertain.
Ah, yes, of course, Mr. Moore said. And she left your employ, you said?
I did not say, Mr. Moore. But she departed from our service the following May, when she was remarried and her nephew was left in her care. I offered her a recommendation, and it would have been an unqualified one, but she said that she wished to pursue a career in nursing. I told her that if I could be of any service in that regard, she should not hesitate to contact me. She never did, and that, gentlemen, is really all I can tell you.
I heard the sound of a door opening, and then a careful little voice said, "Excuse me, sir, but the missus says it's time for you to rest."
"Yes," Mr. Vanderbilt answered, "I'm coming." "Well, gentlemen, I must obey the orders of my physician. I hope you will be able to locate Mrs. Hatch, although I suppose her name must have changed."
"Yes," Mr. Moore said. "Thank you, Mr. Vanderbilt, for seeing us. You have been exceptionally gracious and helpful. Will you be leaving for Newport soon?"
"Tomorrow, in fact, which is why I must gather my strength. I'll have someone show you out."
"Please, sir," the doctor said, "do not trouble yourself. We are quite capable. And thank you once again."
There were some general sounds of movement, and that was my cue. Waiting till just a few people were passing by on the avenue, I ran full out for the iron fence, threw myself up and over it, then landed on the sidewalk and walked breezily away, ignoring the stares of a couple what were strolling by, and trying to look like I'd jumped millionaires' fences every day, twice on Sundays. I got back to the calash a few seconds after the doctor and Mr. Moore had reached it, making it necessary for me to explain where I'd been. This had the advantage of making it unnecessary for them to tell me about their conversation with Mr. Vanderbilt, though my second act of trespassing in a week didn't please the doctor much. But the shock of what they'd heard inside overrode any other considerations.
"I hate this," Mr. Moore said as we started the drive back downtown. "I hate it. It's exactly as Lucius said. Every time we think we're getting somewhere, slap, some new piece of information crops up that changes the whole picture."
"And what makes you so sure that the picture has changed, Moore?" the doctor asked.
"You heard what he said, Kreitzler," Mr. Moore shouted in frustration. "The woman's children were shot down in front of her by a madman. What the hell was that all about?"
The doctor shrugged.
"Any number of things. It may be true. It may also have been a fantasy she created."
"Kreitzler," Mr. Moore answered, banging one hand against the door of the calash in annoyance. "He said he was told about it by friends. What's she doing, going all over the state, making up stories about dead children to gain people's sympathy?"
"Not all over the state. The event occurred near the town where she was born, apparently. So if there's any truth to it at all, your friend in the district attorney's office should be able to tell us about it. Have you been able to contact him yet?"
"I rode on Monday," Mr. Moore answered glumly, settling into a mood that matched the hot, humid weather. "And sent a telegram on Tuesday, but I suppose now I'd better wire him again or try to get him on the telephone, let him know about this." He roused himself just once more.
"And what did he mean about her nephew being left in her care anyway?"
"That," the doctor said, "was almost certainly a fantasy. Or, to be more explicit, a lie. She had to create some story to explain the sudden appearance of the Johansson boy in her life."
"Oh, yes."
Mr. Moore's understanding of this detail didn't cheer him up any.
"Christ, it's like trying to keep up with the machinations of three different people."
"True," the doctor replied. "Layers upon layers."
On hearing that statement, Mr. Moore gave up on trying to make any more sense out of the strange things Mr. Vanderbilt had said and just took to smoking cigarettes and knocking his feet against the wall of the carriage every few minutes, saying, "I hate this," over and over, like we hadn't gotten the point. Dr. Kreitzler tried to get his friend's mind off the thing by going over the front page of the Times, but the news there wasn't such as would cheer any of us up. The police had finally captured Martin Thorne, the suspected culprit in the mystery of the headless body, and, true to Detective Sergeant Lucius's prediction, he'd never left the city during the whole time the manhunt for him had been going on. We had some reason to believe that the distraction of the case would continue a bit longer. Though a confession had been gotten out of Thorne, it conflicted with all the evidence and theories the police had assembled, but at best the case would be resolved in a matter of days. An even greater worry was the fact that Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Mr. Roosevelt's closest friend and political ally in Washington, was openly urging President McKinley to take stronger action against the Spanish Empire in all contested matters. The American War Party was getting impatient, and though we didn't know just what that would mean for our investigation, it didn't seem to indicate anything good. Finally, there was a report of more personal importance to both the doctor and Mr. Moore. Madame Lillian Nordica, one of their favorite singers from the Metropolitan Opera, was critically ill in London. The Times made it seem like she was at death's door, though we eventually found out that the report was exaggerated. But even the possibility of such a loss was enough to cause the doctor to join Mr. Moore in downhearted silence. The rain didn't let up much as we drove downtown, and neither did the stench on the street, which was a very bad sign. Weather of that variety coming at that time of year could take quite a while to blow on out of town. As it turned out, that day did indeed mark the start of the first really dangerous period of the summer, the kind of natural phenomenon what the papers had taken to calling a heat wave. For the next week, average temperatures would not fall below the 80s, and even at night, the humid air and lack of wind would make sleep just about impossible. This situation was not helped by the fact that our investigation soon narrowed down to the tedious business of continuing the search for a talkative member of the group of women whose kids had been under Nurse Hunter's care at the lying-in hospital, a job what had me driving the detective sergeants and Miss Howard to dismal parts of the city, or worse yet, out to the suburbs over the next few days, as well as waiting for Mr. Moore to hear from his old pal up in Boston Spa. By the following Monday, some of us were beginning to doubt the existence of this person. Mr. Moore had sent not one but two cables to the man, telling him what we were up to, but he'd had no reply. Such didn't necessarily mean anything one way or the other, but it was, given our circumstances and the weather, cause for much frustration. Add fear to that mix, and you had a truly rocky time. This last emotion came first in the form of occasional appearances in the Stuyvesant Park area by members of the Hudson Dusters. They made no threatening moves, being as they weren't interested in getting into a scrape so far outside their territory. But it was clear that they wanted to remind us that they were around and that, cops or no cops, we'd be better off minding our own business. Unsettling as these visits were, they didn't compare to the several sightings by some members of our team, including me, of El Nino, the Filipino pygmy employed by Señor Linares. Like the Dusters, this little man made no attempt to attack or even threaten any of us. But he was there and watching, knives and arrows at the ready should our investigation actually start to move forward in some kind of dramatic way. As all of this was happening, the detective sergeants also had to pursue their investigation of affairs at the Doctors' Institute. They hadn't reported their progress on this matter to anyone in our group, hadn't said anything about it at all, in fact, excepting the time they'd requested information from Cyrus concerning the staff of the place, and another occasion when they'd asked me if I'd seen anything in Paulie McPherson's behavior that might help explain his suicide. I'd told them I hadn't, and from the disappointed way they nodded at me in reply, I took it that they hadn't been having much better luck digging information up anywhere else. Then, on Monday the 12th, the detective sergeants showed up at 17th Street looking pretty grim. It was late in the afternoon, and the heat wave was still going strong. In fact, the weather claimed its first victim that day, a small child who was struck down by sunstroke and taken to the Hudson Street Hospital. Not far, I immediately thought, when I heard the news, from the house where Libby Hatch lived her life as Nurse Elspeth Hunter. The doctor was in his study working, Cyrus was out in the carriage house tending to the horses, and I was in the kitchen helping Mrs. Leshko clean up half a dozen plates, what she'd smashed to bits with the end of a mop during a moment of typically vigorous but destructive cleaning. When the doorbell rang, I ran to answer it, leaving a wailing Mrs. Leshko to the last of the sweeping up. The detective sergeants were all business when they came in, immediately asking where the doctor was. I told them he was in his study, and they marched right upstairs, looking like they'd been hoping to avoid this moment but were now resigned to it. There wasn't any way I was going to miss what came next. I let them get a floor or so ahead of me, then followed on up at the same distance, finally dashing to the study door when I heard it close. Creeping carefully, I made my way to the thing, then lay on the carpeted floor and peered through the narrow crack underneath it, seeing several pairs of feet along with the bottoms of many piles of books and papers. "We're sorry to bother you, Doctor," I heard Marcus say as his feet came to rest in front of the legs of one of the chairs near the doctor's desk, "but we thought we'd better let you know what's going on with the other matter." There was a pause, and Lucius's feet started tapping nervously between the legs of the sofa. "The news isn't bad, exactly, but we can't really say it's good, either." The doctor drew a heavy breath. "Well, gentlemen?" "So far as we can tell," Marcus said, "there's no reason to believe that the McPherson boy's suicide was prompted by anything or anyone at your institute. We've questioned and re-questioned the entire staff and put together a general chronology of events from the time the boy arrived to the time he died. There's simply nothing that suggests he was treated in a way that would have sparked self-destructive tendencies." "Even members of the staff who don't particularly like each other," Lucius added carefully, "not that there are more than two or three of them, can't find fault with each other's behavior toward the boy. As for family, assuming he was going by his right name, we really can't find any relations at all." "I tried myself," the doctor added quietly, "without success." "We checked out the cord he used," Marcus said, trying to sound more optimistic, "and it doesn't match the materials found in any of the drapery or curtain mechanisms in the building, which means he must have brought it in with him. Which suggests that he'd been contemplating the act before he got there," Lucius said. "And that," Marcus continued, "will be useful in court, I think. Now, about that court date." There was another pause before Marcus went on. "Judge Reinhardt, who was in charge of your initial hearing, neglected to inform anyone that he's retiring at the end of this month. His caseload has been farmed out to a series of other magistrates. You, I'm afraid, have drawn Judge Samuel Wells." I heard a hiss come out of the doctor. "Yes, you've crossed paths with him before, we understand," Marcus said. "Several times," the doctor answered quietly. "We don't know him," Lucius said, "but we hear that he's fairly stern." "That's not my main concern," replied the doctor. "He can be stern, yes, but I've seen him be lenient as well, and that is the difficulty. He is utterly unpredictable. I've never been able to anticipate his reactions precisely enough to structure my testimony accordingly. In addition, he is not a man who requires extensive evidence of wrongdoing in matters such as these. If the state chooses to make a case that throws serious moral opprobrium on the Institute, which it will almost certainly do," Marcus said, "then the mere fact that the McPherson boy died while in my care may be enough for Wells." "Yes," Lucius's voice was a strange mixture of hope and gloominess. "That's why we thought we'd better come to let you know that it's really going to ride on the hearing itself. It's been delayed a bit, by the way. Apparently, Wells will be on vacation until the first week of September, and—" The sudden sound of people entering the house and loud voices echoing up the staircase made me stop listening and jerk my head around. Then, realizing that the doctor and the detective sergeants could probably hear it too, I got to my feet and started downstairs, not wanting to get caught eavesdropping. Looking down between the banisters, I could just see Mr. Moore, Miss Howard, and Cyrus pounding up the stairs. "Well then, where the hell is he?" Mr. Moore was asking in a loud, breathless voice.
I believe that the doctor is in his study, Mr. Moore," Cyrus explained in a baffled and not altogether pleased tone. "If you'll just let me..."
"No, no," Mr. Moore answered. "We'll tell him. We'll all tell him. Come on, Cyrus. You're part of this, too. You'd better hear about it."
They kept on coming up at the same fast pace, Mr. Moore taking the stairs two at a time, and when he saw me, just about falling in a faint at my feet.
"Stevie," he breathed. "Is he up there? My God, I've run across half a damn city."
"Oh, really, John?" Miss Howard said. She was a little out of breath, too, but nothing to match Mr. Moore. "From your house to my house to 17th Street hardly constitutes half the city. If you just get some blasted exercise occasionally..."
"It is a well-known fact," Mr. Moore panted, "that too much exercise is not good for you, and I'm living proof just at the moment. Well, Stevie?"
I indicated the study with a nod. "He's in there, with the detective sergeants." That got Mr. Moore right back up.
"Excellent," he said. "Saves any more running around."
He made for the study door, the rest of us behind him, and I was surprised when he didn't bother knocking, but just burst on in. The doctor looked up from his desk, a little shocked and, like Cyrus, a little miffed at the lack of courtesy. The detective sergeants got to their feet, also looking surprised, as Mr. Moore leaned on the doorknob and kept on panting. Then he held up an envelope.
"This just arrived. Special delivery from Rupert Picton."
He took another deep breath.
"I really do hate this case."
Chapter 26. Mr. Moore opened the envelope as Cyrus, Miss Howard, and I filed into the study with the others. Unfolding the letter inside, our exhausted friend took a deep breath and tried to start reading it, but he'd only gotten as far as the salutation, "Moore, you swine," before he fell to his knees, still trying to catch his breath. Handing the letter to Miss Howard, he said, "Sarah, you read it," then crawled over to the sofa and pulled himself up onto it.
"What the devil's the matter with him, Sarah?" the doctor asked. "Is he drunk, or has he merely been shot?"
"Worse," Miss Howard answered. "He's been running, but he's right about the letter, doctor. Listen to this. It's dated yesterday. Moore, you swine, I would take the time to elaborate on what a mud-dwelling, feculent..."
"You don't have to read that part," Mr. Moore protested from the sofa.
Miss Howard only smiled and went on. "But the communications from you, which I found heaped on my desk when I returned from the Adirondacks today, actually must take precedence. All joking aside, John, listen to me. If you have indeed, in your infinite wisdom, managed to get yourself mixed up in a private investigation that is directed at the woman who was known in this town as Libby Hatch, then be as careful as you know how to be. The story you heard from Mr. Vanderbilt is indeed true, or rather, is the commonly accepted explanation of a horrendous crime that occurred here just over 3 years ago. Her three children were shot, supposedly by an itinerant Negro lunatic who was never seen by anyone but Mrs. Hatch. Two of the children died. The third survived, but has been mute ever since. An extensive search failed to produce any sign of the Negro or of anyone who'd even gotten so much as a glimpse of the man. Nevertheless, the case never got past a coroner's inquest, so effective was Mrs. Hatch's inventiveness and so scarce the support for any other interpretation. I had my own ideas, and having been through what you have, I'm sure you can guess what they were. As to the other matters you say you are looking into, I am appalled but not surprised to learn of them. The woman is, I believe, one of the most dangerous persons alive. It's a pity I couldn't ever convince anyone else of that. You indicate that your investigation in New York is at a bit of a standstill. If this is true, I advise you to take it as a sign. Make no more direct moves against Libby Hatch yourself. And if the people you're working with are even semi-capable investigators, waste no time getting up here with them. Dr. Chrysler, I of course know by his writings and reputation, and I should be delighted to make his acquaintance. Wire me if and when you're coming. I am in deadly earnest, John. Don't try to beat this woman with an informal investigation. Even if you had the entire police department on it with you, I should worry. She'd find a way to con them all and kill you if it came to that. Either leave the thing be or get up here and we'll see what we can do together. Any other course will be disastrous. Your friend, Rupert Picton." Miss Howard folded up the sheet of paper and replaced it in the envelope. "That's all," she said. The doctor just sat still for a moment, then looked over to the sofa where Mr. Moore appeared to have recovered.
He seems quite a colorful fellow, this friend of yours, Moore.
Don't let the banter fool you, Mr. Moore answered, going for a box of cigarettes that sat on the doctor's desk. He's got one of the sharpest legal minds I've ever run across. He could have had any job in the state, but like the fool he is, he decided to play it straight instead. Cried bloody murder to the legislature about corruption in the city DA's office, and got run out of town on a rail. There were rumors about some kind of a mental breakdown after that. Mr. Moore lit his cigarette. I never really got the details.
Cyrus spoke up in a slightly perplexed voice.
Then he's saying that she shot the children?
Yes, Miss Howard answered. He seems quite certain of it.
More victims to add to the roster, Lucius said.
They could have been the ones in the picture, I threw in, the photograph I saw on the desk of the three older kids together.
It would make sense, Lucius answered. You can't exactly induce cyanosis in three children who are old enough